trace your path from, you know, an islander who really moved to the top echelon of government of Canada, both at the Senate, but also through politics, provincial, federal. Tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up and how you got into some of these political activities.
Well, I was born in Charlottetown and I had the good fortune to go to UPI. In fact, I'm the first graduate from UPI to serve in the Parliament of Canada. And then I was actively involved and very interested and intrigued by public policy and politics, inspired by premiers when I was growing up, like Alex Campbell and others. And then got involved with the Liberal Party and was involved for years provincially and then active federally and enjoyed it very much.
And I know you've worked with a number of very senior political officials in PEI. You worked with Joe Giz, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
And what was your time like with politics and PEI? And there's a lot of things going on, including the Confederation Bridge at that time. How was that period?
Well, it was fascinating. Premier Giz was an outstanding leader, extremely bright, obviously, a master's in law from Harvard. He led a very progressive, sensitive government. And I think he retired. He was more popular the day he retired than the day he started, which is an amazing tribute to his commitment and his ability.
Little bit before my time, I was younger, but certainly had a dramatic impact on the province, and we're fortunate to have people of his caliber making offer for public life. You moved there to Ottawa, and you got involved in politics in Ottawa. Most intrigued probably at the senior levels you've held within even Jean Chrétien's government. Describe kind of how somebody from PEI can move up to that level and have that kind of a senior relationship with the Government of Canada.
Well, actually, I'm the second Islander to have that, what we now call the Chief of Staff position to the Prime Minister. The first was Joseph Pope, who lived in what is now Argowan, and he was Principal Secretary, I believe they call it at the time, to John A. Macdonald. He was born in PEI, worked provincially, and then moved to Ottawa and had a similar career. So he was 100 years before me, mind you. He was born in 1854, and I was born in 1954.
It's a big gap. There's a lot of Islanders didn't move up to that.
That's right. There's 100 years there where we were empty. But I read his bios and information. It was kind of interesting. One of the most interesting part is, of course, that his sister has a statue now in Ottawa. If you're, you or your viewers are ever there across from the Chateau Laurier, there's a statue of Georgina Pope, okay, who many call the Florence Nightingale of the Canadian Armed Forces, Boer War, First World War, who returned to Charlottetown and died in, I believe, 1936-38. So it was a very impressive family. It strikes me funny that he was, in effect, the Chief of Staff to John A., but she has the statue, so that shows you the importance of the two positions.
Well, John A. is hard to find statues for these days. Question just on your tenure in the Senate. And when did you become a member of the Senate of Canada? And I wanted to talk a little bit about the many committees that you've chaired and some of the initiatives you've undertaken on behalf of Canadians in the Senate. But give us that kind of background on.
Sure. I went directly from Prime Minister Chrétien's office to the Senate. So that was in 2003. And I've been there on various committees, as you indicated. I've been Vice Chair of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, which is a very important committee for Prince Edward Island. We're highly dependent on trade, and trade takes many different avenues, many different opportunities. For example, our trade with Taiwan has tripled over the last decade because of the monks we have in Eastern PEI. They're connected to a series of supermarkets in Taiwan.
That's something you wouldn't even think about.
Yeah,
I wouldn't think about.
And they carry a lot of organic products from PEI, jams, canola, whole host of things. If they're organic, they'll sell them. So our trade has tripled there. You know, we're a small province, 160,000, 170,000 people. Taiwan has over 20 million, so there's a great opportunity there. Everybody's rushing to mainland China, which...
And there's some geopolitical tensions there now.
Exactly, and complexities of dealing with them. And Taiwan is sitting there for a small province like PEI. It's a golden opportunity. And that's just but one example. You know, we have signed numerous trade agreements with places like Peru and Jordan and a host of other countries, obviously in addition to the United States, which is our main trading partner. But there's opportunities to expand. I meet business people who are selling in Argentina and so on. So that was an important committee for PEI to be on.
And has your impact on that trade policy committee, has it helped Islanders open up export markets? Is it, I know you're representing Canadians in the Senate, but is it beneficial? You mentioned the monks, that they have a lot of trade. Is there other Islanders that have benefited from some of these agreements? Not specific Islanders, but has it helped our export?
I think so. It's a long game. You have to put a lot of hours in. For example, I'm hosting for lunch this Thursday the ambassador from Vietnam and the ambassador from Turkey.
Oh.
And we have
here in Charlottetown?
Here in Charlottetown.
Oh, that's great.
And we have about at least four students from Turkey at UPEI. We have an educational exchange agreement between UPEI and an educational institution in Turkey. We have over 50 students from Vietnam, and we have a growing Vietnam population. Now, yeah. Vietnam is a developing country. A lot of the factories are moving out of China because of the lower labor cost, but it's a massive population with a growing middle class. They're going to be looking for what we sell too. And we have a lot of quality items we can sell all over the world. So it's a constant competition among all countries, all provinces, and we have to be in the game, and I think we are.
That's excellent. Now, what other committees? I know I looked at your list of committees. You've been on a lot, you've chaired a lot. One that was appealing to me is your early on, you were responsible for the Department of Veteran Affairs. One of the most important pieces of federal infrastructure we probably have in the province, if not the city, and we're blessed to have that and the contribution it makes to our economy. Do you see that as a long-term, sustainable department that's safe here in PEI, or is it always under some threat of relocation or downsizing? I mean, I think that the department has been really successful in diversifying beyond just supporting veterans and into new areas. Is it a pretty reliable piece of federal infrastructure?
Yeah, I think if you look back when the department was originally announced for PEI decades ago now, 40 or 50 years, you'll see the media coverage was basically, well, it's nice it's coming here, but really, what future does it have? The head of the real estate, PEI Real Estate Association, said it doesn't have a future. You know, it's going to help for a few years. Well, the reality is, 50 years later, they have 1,600 employees in PEI and an annual payroll of $122 million. So take those employees and that payroll out of PEI.
And those houses.
And you have a very different, yes, that real estate agent.
Yeah.
President was quite wrong. You take those employees and payroll out of PEI, you have a major gap in our economy. So you're right, the department has developed an expertise, particularly dealing with seniors, aging population, and healthcare and benefits. And there's good application for that across the government. So I think the department is here for a long time. The concern, of course, is that it's the only national headquarters mm-hmm. outside the greater Ottawa area. And a bunch of us are now working on that to see if we can relocate, for example, fisheries and oceans to Sydney, Cape Breton, because the Coast Guard is already there. The pandemic has shown that people can work remotely, can work anywhere. They don't have to be, in the case of fisheries, they're in a high-rise office tower in Kent Street.
Not many oceans around Kent Street.
Yeah, that's right. You can't see any oceans from Kent Street in downtown Ottawa. So there's an opportunity to expand that, and that will solidify the department here in that it won't be a one-off. There will be others here as well.
It's good to see that devolution. We're uniquely benefiting from that, you know, head office that's here. What are some of your most memorable occasions through your whole career, but primarily as Senate, which is what you're kind of doing today, but any really interesting things that stand out as a memorable moment?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it was 9/11 when the first plane hit the tower. Everybody thought it was a mistake, of course, a tragic accident. When the second plane hit the tower, everybody realized it was a terrorist attack. I was the chief of staff at the time. I picked up the phone, called the prime minister. He had been alerted by the household staff. He was having a meeting at the time, I believe, with the premier of Saskatchewan. He immediately asked me to come over. We went over. There was great confusion over what was going on. We had all these planes coming in from Europe and Asia that had to be diverted to Canada. The decision was made that we would take them away from the major centers like Montreal and Toronto, Vancouver, and send them to places like Gander and Halifax. I remember at the time inquiring about Charlottetown and was somewhat relieved, quite frankly, to hear the runway at the time was too short right. for them to land, because the assumption was there might be terrorists on them and they would crash the plane. And to that end, we sent the policy people off to draft some remarks, you know, expressing outrage, but support for the Americans in their time of need. And the Prime Minister decided to deliver those remarks on Parliament Hill. So we're leaving 24 Sussex, where the Prime Minister at the time then lived, and we're driving up in the motorcade. And just in front of the National Gallery in Ottawa, the phone in the car rings. The Prime Minister answers it. It's the military people telling him that there's two Korean airliners flying in near Whitehorse. One has put the international sign that they've been hijacked and they can't communicate with the second one, and they were seeking permission to shoot the plane down if it headed towards Vancouver. The planes were headed to the United States, but if they headed towards Vancouver, that would be off course. They wanted authority to shoot them down. You know, obviously it's the decision of the Prime Minister, but he looked at me, I looked at him in the back seat, and he would be seeking my advice. And, you know, I wondered, how the hell did I end up here?
I don't think I've heard that story. And, yeah. and I'm sure there's a lot of, you know, high tension incidents around that yeah. time. Was there a lot of pressure cooker incidents like that when you're in the Prime Minister's office? Yeah. Are you always under some kind of threat or pressure?
Well, obviously not shooting planes down, but there's always these things that are important, and everything flows in, everything crazy flows to the Prime Minister's office. So, you know, on a Friday night, I get a call from the then Agricultural Minister. We think we have a mad cow disease in Western Canada. Well, that's devastating for the agricultural community. So there was constant events, as they say, yeah. Going on, and those were never ending. The Prime Minister, of course, was very experienced. He had been in government for 40 years. He knew how things worked, and he was very cool under pressure. So he knew he was accountable for whatever decisions were made, and he didn't have trouble making decisions.
Yeah. So to get from PEI to the Prime Minister's office to be providing guidance on affairs of national security, then to the Senate, different pace and different tempo. How would you compare the two experiences? Do you have a preference over one or?
Well, the Prime Minister's office is not something you do a long time because the pressure the never ends. I'll give you a little story. When after I got appointed to the Senate, we were going out to a movie, the whole family and I. My youngest daughter came running out and saying, "Daddy, you forgot your cell phone." And I said, "I don't need it, honey." She said, "What?" I said, "I don't need it." She was used to
always
being pulled away from dinners, yeah. Thanksgiving. You know, Prime Minister called me, President Bush just called him. They're going to bomb in the Middle East, and so on and so on. So there was always, you were always on call 24/7. And the calls were never anybody saying, "You guys are doing a great job. Right. Everything's wonderful." It was always, "We have a problem."
Yeah. Do you think that's a problem with politics? I mean, I think a lot of people get into politics, and Prime Minister Chrétien was long experience, but newer people, when they get exposed to that pressure and that demand and that insatiable criticism, is that a deterrent for people to make
so? But criticism is, you know, really free expression, so it comes with the job. Not everybody agreed with what we were doing. Mr. Chrétien did a host of things. For example, he extended maternity leave to 12 months. There was opposition to that. There was violent opposition to staying out of the Middle Eastern war that the Americans were proclaiming. Mr. Chrétien made it very clear at the time in discussions with Tony Blair and others. And on these calls, senior staff are on them as well. Made it very clear to them, wait for the UN to find the weapons of mass destruction and then we'll be there. It was never that Canada wasn't going to be there. We right. just wanted proof that these weapons were there. It turned out
they couldn't find them.
They were never there. So we stayed out. That was highly controversial, yes, for the business community. They were terribly upset that the border would harden, that it would be slow, it would affect their economy. But history proved it was the absolute right decision to make, and Tony Blair in particular is wearing that to this day in the United Kingdom when he made a different decision.
Yes, yeah, a lot of consequences to these decisions. One area that I really want to talk on, maybe we'll take a break, and you've suggested some songs, and we'll connect to those and come back, but I really want to talk about some of the work you've done on behalf of Islanders and a campaign for fairness to help reduce some of the costs that Islanders are experiencing to travel across the bridge and the ferry. And love your perspectives on that, where that came about, and the work that you've done over a long period of time. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes to find out more about some of the specific initiatives that Senator Percy Down has worked on behalf of Islanders. Again, Senator Percy Down, and you've done had a lot of impact, and I don't think that's recognized exceptionally well. I think you're incredibly humble person, both in politics and in private. And one of the things that I've noticed is some very prominent thing. Well, there's a few, and maybe I'll ask you, what are some of the things that you've taken greatest pride in on behalf of Islanders?
Well, I think one of the things I enjoyed the results of, and again, you work with many people to get these results. Nobody does it on their own. But I was at a Senate Finance Committee very early in my years in the Senate, and I noticed the expenditures for the guaranteed income supplement were very, very low compared to what the projections were. So when I quizzed the finance people, and they were reluctant to talk about it, when eventually got to the bottom of it, we found that it was extremely difficult to apply for. There was a whole bunch of barriers. And this is a significant program, particularly in PEI. This is additional income for low-income Islanders.
So there's barriers for the people who need it most to access the funds.
Exactly.
Okay.
What happened was first of all, you had to file income tax to get it. Well, if you're a senior and you don't owe any income, you don't have to file taxes.
Or a low-income Islander, you might not even know how to file taxes.
And you don't want to pay somebody 50 or 70 bucks to do it.
Yeah.
Not realizing that's one of the triggers for guaranteed income supplement. There was no retroactive payments other than a year. You know, if you haven't paid your taxes, they go back right to day one. There was a whole host of measures that made it very difficult. So when I started to raise this, I suddenly started to get I had in the local media here, putting pressure on, which is important. And I suddenly started to get all kinds of phone calls. A nun called me from Summerside to say, well, she had three or four people that she didn't realize they weren't getting the guaranteed income supplement. She mentioned this to them. So a host of us got involved in this, and we conducted a campaign. Now, like everything else, it takes years to move government around. But 7 or 8 years later, almost all those barriers are gone. You had to reapply, for example, the GI guaranteed income supplement. Now, once you get it, it's automatic and a whole bunch of things. So that means a lot of money for people who desperately need it. These are people who have extremely low income, and they're seniors. So that was very... rewarding, I found, to have that fixed, and the numbers, the money the government booked was actually now going out, as opposed to millions and millions every year not being claimed. They knew how many people were entitled.
But they didn't release it.
They didn't get it, so.
And that's back in the news again today. Mm-hmm. It's been talked that PEI might be a nice little microcosm to test a broader implementation. Is that a reasonable thing to look at? Is it feasible?
Well, there's concerns about that. The government of BC, which, as you know, is an NDP government, did a study on guaranteed income for basic income for all citizens, and they found the cost was going to be twice what the provincial economy was at the current time. So that's a problem. I think there's a case to be made for trying a trial run here. And the results will speak for themselves. It may or may not be sustainable.
Are there measures I don't know, that's just all conceptual, but would there be measures to ensure people who weren't entitled didn't get it, or it wasn't an inducement to not be engaged in the labor market?
Well, that's why you do these trial runs.
Yeah.
You do a trial run here, trial project here, and you'll see what happened. You measure all those at the end of it. Did the labor force participation go down? Did it go up? Did it remain the same? What happened to inflation, for example? What happened to housing? So there's all kinds of things. But a trial run would be interesting. It would answer these questions one way or the other.
Inflation's a big issue.
Big
affecting
issue.
A lot of things, not least of which is transportation. But what are some other sort of things that you've touched and seen and impacted that you have some pride in?
Well, I've done a lot of work on Veterans Affairs issues over the years. There was a lot of discrepancy there. For example, I was at what we call Norman's grocery store, Brighton Clover Farm, one day, and I met a veteran coming out. He just told me he was at a funeral for a friend of his, and they all had chip in $100 for the burial. I said, what are you talking about? He's entitled to what they call the last post fund, which is for veterans who have served our country, can have a funeral. Well, it turned out that amount was capped on how much, and of course the price of funerals have gone up dramatically since it was capped. So that's another issue we raised, and the government after 2 or 3 years, and this is why things take incredibly long. The government announced, to much fanfare, they were increasing the amount of the last post fund, but what they did not change was the amount per funeral, which was of no benefit at all. Right. It wasn't that there wasn't enough money there, it was that the cap was too low. And so when I heard that veteran say that day that they all had to throw in $100 past the hat to bury a colleague they served with, that's simply unacceptable. Unacceptable. That person served our country. They obviously fell on hard times. Who knows what their condition was? Was it post-traumatic stress or poverty, whatever? And we couldn't afford a proper funeral. Country like Canada, that shouldn't ever happen. So that's another issue we worked on. And eventually, we did get the last post fund higher, but it still has to go higher. But again, years and years go by before you get these changes.
So you need a long horizon as a senator and maybe even as a parliamentarian. Okay. What are some other things that have kind of crossed your desk?
The most recent one, of course, is the tolls on Confederation Bridge. And when PEI agreed to tolls, and there had to be a constitutional change, it was the Premier Joseph Gill's government agreed to it, and it's a wonderful bridge, and nobody would want to revert back to what we had before. It was well understood we had to pay a user fee for the bridge, just like we paid for the ferries, so there was no change there. What did change, however, was in 2015, in the middle of the federal election, two of the political parties, the NDP and the Liberals, announced that they would change the long-time user pay infrastructure policy by taking off the proposed tolls on the new Champlain Bridge in Montreal. The first Champlain Bridge had tolls until 1969, when they were removed, when the bridge was paid for. And then the new bridge had to be constructed. The old one had ended its lifespan. And there would be tolls. Everybody agreed that was fine. The middle election, the NDP and Liberals said, if we win, no tolls. Liberals won, no tolls. But what happened was, we were then left in the sidelines. We were left with these tolls. The deal changed and we weren't considered in that. So now it becomes a real hindrance to trade, to prosperity, to people taking their children to Halifax for health care. Somebody who needs a passport quickly has to pay an additional $50, the bridge toll. I asked the parliamentary budget officer, he's an independent agent of parliament, to do an assessment of how much the tolls were on Champlain Bridge, what the subsidy would be versus what it is for Confederation Bridge and Wood Island Ferry. And he determined that it's $91 million more. And what that means is we could reduce the tolls. The government of Canada can reduce the tolls on Confederation Bridge and Wood Island Ferry to $20 and still pay less than they're paying on the subsidy to Champlain Bridge. So that's another fairness issue, just like this guaranteed income, just like the last post fund and others.
You've done a lot of work on that. I think you sent a circular out to all islanders, and it was well articulated on the costs and the benefits and the communications that have been made both by the Prime Minister of Canada and our current Premier during the election cycle. Is the cost of this, so as an islander, I would love to see that zero. 20, I think, is a fair user pay system, but is it feasible? Is it a request that's too great to ask of a federal government? Is the $77 million or whatever that works out to be, is that something that's a reasonable request?
No, it's not unreasonable because it's the change the government undertook when they changed the user pay. They flipped that policy around. Islanders, I never complained. I didn't like paying the toll, but I understood it was the reason we got the bridge we have, which is wonderful. But once they changed the rules, then it's grossly unfair that we're stuck with $50. And the toll on the Champlain Bridge was quite low. It was going to be $1.75 or $2.25, given the volume of traffic.
Right.
That's understandable.
Yeah.
But if they had a toll of a dollar on that bridge, or a loony, I would cease my campaign because then they're paying. But they're not paying. And we're a rich country, and the subsidy would still be lower than what they're paying on the Champlain Bridge if they reduce the tolls to 20 on the Wood Islands Ferry and the bridge. So it's very doable.
And you started this campaign for fairness in 2019, is that right? How's that been going? Because, you know, I saw the circular, it came out, it was a bit of news excitement, and like many things in politics, it's hard to maintain the momentum. What's the status and how do we get islanders motivated to try to take this issue forward and fulfill the initiative that you started a few years back.
Well, this is one of the interesting comparisons. What happened in Quebec, which is a case study. The Premier of Quebec, the Mayor of Montreal, we need a new bridge. The government of Canada said, we'll build your bridge. There's a toll on it. Great, we need a bridge. Then they all switched gears. No tolls. The Premier, the Mayor of Montreal, no tolls.
Of course.
And that same unity has not been in PEI. I've had great success with the Summerside City Council. They passed a motion to this effect. The PEI Fishermen's Association, now the Summerside Chamber of Commerce, is taking up the torch, but a lot of parts of PEI society that should be active are quiet. Makes it much harder. Having said that, everything takes a long time. So we will look for the next federal election and to a lesser degree the provincial election to see what opportunities are there to make it a campaign issue provincially and federally, to see who will commit to taking some action to correcting this wrong. And then, so, like the others, we'll have success.
Is it a political initiative? Is that what we need now, is to really get pitchforks and torches and rally the islanders behind a common cause to kind of support this change? And really, it's an equity issue. It's a fairness with other counterparts and other federal infrastructure. That could be a little while. We don't know when the next election could be triggered. So what are the things that islanders or anybody watching this today could take upon themselves to kind of support this initiative that you started?
Well, write all the party leaders federally, the provincial premier, the MPs, the other senators. There's only two or one other senator now, but there may be more by the time this is broadcast. And keep the pressure on. None of these things are easy. It takes a long time to turn the ship of state around on a policy. But it was done in the heat of a campaign. Maybe it will be done in the heat of the next campaign. Once somebody does it, I suspect others will match it, and then the game will be afoot.
I don't know if you can speak to politics at all and the change in temperature given your current situation, but do you see the opportunity for some political parties to take this mantle, as they did in the election with the Champlain Bridge? Mm-hmm. Could this become an issue that could rise to the forefront if enough people...
Well, sure. If it's a close election, for example, and every seat's invaluable.
Even the four tiny little PEI, four seats, that could be a...
Yeah, if somebody thinks it's going to be a complete horse race, and, you know, Stanfield lost the election back in the 70s with, I think, one or two seats. So every seat becomes important, and somebody promises, and the candidates here for all the parties say, this is an issue, this is a problem, then the other party will address it too. And again, the money is there. There's the government announced the infrastructure fund, which is for transportation to grow the economy. They can use that money has been underutilized.
So there's a pot of money they're not even deploying? Yeah. Again, how many of these do you know about in the Senate?
And the reality is that fund clearly identifies infrastructure.
Yep.
So why not infrastructure already existing that has this barrier? I heard from an agricultural person 3 or 4 years ago, that year they spent $66,000 getting their produce off PEI on that bridge. $66,000
in one calendar year. A fee that their competitors aren't paying.
Right. So the person in Capital A selling the same thing is not paying that.
Right.
That means that person A doesn't have the additional profit, doesn't hire an additional employee, because $66,000 went to the bridge.
Right. Well, we need to operate the bridge. It's an important piece of infrastructure.
Absolutely.
But I think the argument on equity and fairness is should be an issue for all islanders.
Absolutely.
Any closing thoughts on what you see as the next sort of steps for the future of the Senate or the future of Percy Down? Or
I think the important thing is if we can get some regional development. PEI has been successful with the only national headquarters, Veterans Affairs outside Ottawa. We also have a regional office of the GST in Summerside. We should have that same success in other areas that are suffering from unemployment. Cape Breton, hopefully, Northern New Brunswick, something in Newfoundland, Labrador. There's no need for the federal departments. Obviously, you have to have defense and finance and Bank of Canada in Ottawa, but you don't need, environment department. You don't need export development.
Fisheries.
Agriculture could be in Saskatchewan. Export development could be in Vancouver if our focus is Asia. So all those things will meet tremendous resistance, as did Veterans Affairs. Veterans Affairs relocation was supposed to be one of many. after that was done, they canceled the program. So we have to restart that now. And the pandemic, the silver lining of the pandemic has shown that with technology, we can be anywhere in the country, and those jobs and benefits should be spread out across the country. The other thing is, you know, the 1,600 current employees of veterans and $122 million a year payroll, what's not captured in those figures is people who have now retired from there and are getting
right,
a pension.
They're still here and have a commitment and have family. And
exactly.
It's a great thing.
And people, you know, I see them at the hockey games. I see them at the basketball game. They're contributing to the community. They're buying houses. It's fantastic.
Well, we need more of that. And I hope your next 25 years in the Senate, you can achieve more of those things that you've started. So on behalf of everybody watching the exchange, I want to thank you for joining us today and participating and sharing some of the things you've been up to. Really interested in the efforts that you've made on the fare reductions for our transportation links, and I hope that work continues.
Thank you very much, Blake.
Thank you so much.